Working Cows Podcast, episode 205.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. This is Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. I am very excited to be joined today by Dr. Jonathan Lundgren. Dr. Jonathan Lundgren is an entomologist and an agroecologist, and he's also one of the people leading the team at Blue Dasher Farms and the Ecdysis Foundation, and really just trying to spread the good news about what bugs are good for, what insects are good for, what role they play in a healthy ecosystem. And so I just wanted to talk to him today about that. How do we maybe start to change our perspective about why the bugs that are here and what we can do to affect the population of the good indicator species and what we can do to mitigate the damage done by those that maybe aren't as helpful. So, Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, thank you for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for asking.
So, you know, I guess looking at your Twitter handle, Bug Lundgren, and that's an interesting choice. I there's a few others out there. Chris Nichols is Glow Malin, and some others that kind of just come right out and say what their emphasis is. So I guess, could you talk to me a little bit about the role of insects? And I mean, that's obviously a broad topic, but just the role of insects in a farming system or in a ranching system.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we can't farm or survive on this planet without insects. So they're extremely important. Most ecosystems function based on what those insects do out there in the habitat. Insects are kind of this very tangible sort of aspect of life that farmers can watch and see out there on their farms. Most people think the only good bug is a dead bug, and that's not true. In fact, that if that was the truth, we would probably be, when our management decisions end up focusing on just those pests, it ends up coming at a tremendous cost to our farming operation. Mm-hmm. We just did one study in California almonds where we looked at insect diversity across a range of different production systems of almonds out there in California, and profitability of the almond orchard scaled directly with how many bugs you had. So the more insects, the more money you make. The more insects, the more soil carbon you have. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great indicator of life and what life does out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one time I was talking to somebody and I made the statement that a lot of farm fields are essentially petri dishes, and they stopped me in the middle of my sentence and corrected me and said, no, petri dishes for growing life. Many farm fields are devoid of life, unfortunately. Mm. And I thought that was interesting. So you said that many people think the only good bug is a dead bug. You know, if things are in balance, will those quote unquote negative insects or things that we would think as a pest, will there be species that are their predators come in and interact with them in a way that their negative effects are mitigated?
You know, that's what the farmers have been showing me. It wasn't supposed to work that way, right? I mean, as in entomology school, I was trained that you are supposed to go out. Pests are inevitable, and you better go out there and you better scout, because you're going to have pests, and the best thing you can hope for is to be able to control those things at just the right time so you don't lose too much money. But what the farmers were showing me that we're now are being called regenerative farms, where they were showing me that they didn't have pests, and they weren't even all that focused on pests. It was through soil health practices and other ecosystem management practices, making their farm more resilient and profitable. And they just found that the insect pests weren't an issue anymore. And so partially we've set out trying to figure out why that is. Diversity is the key. The more species you have, the more things they do, the more balance that you have. And what it essentially means is that we're creating our own pest problems through our management decisions. If you have a pest on your farm or ranch or wherever, that's because your system is out of whack. And until you solve the underlying problems, and invariably that is not enough life on the farm and too much disturbance, which means, you know, maybe it's tillage or application of a jug or some other thing. If you have those circumstances, you get pests. And until you solve the underlying issue, you know, get your checkbook out, because you're going to keep on spending money.
So let's apply this to my neighborhood quickly, or not quickly, but just go in that direction for a moment. Most of the people around here kind of let the alfalfa grass hay mix grow until the weevils start to beat them to it, and then they will go out and harvest that before the weevils get it, or they'll spray it.
Yeah.
What's out of whack there? Where's the relationship? What do we do? I mean, you've mentioned some of the things that we can do as far as diversity, but how would you approach that situation without trying to solve the problem with a chemical?
Number one is don't grow just alfalfa. Grow a diverse poly mix. It ends up being better feed, I think, at the end of the day, and provides the livestock the variability of nutrients that they require to survive and thrive. It also beats the pest populations, because now what nature hates is a monoculture. I mean, essentially, all pests are trying to do is reset the balance in the plant community. And we keep on like fighting against them. We're like, okay, nope, we're going to make a completely unbalanced plant community. And then, geez, why do these insects keep on trying to eat it all? Well, because that doesn't happen in nature. You don't see monocultures in nature very often. And there's a good reason for that, because nature loves a balance. And so if we farm in that mentality, then we find that pest problems just aren't as big of an issue anymore. Sometimes not even an issue at all. And so getting livestock on that alfalfa field that's getting hammered by weevils would be another option for them. And
this is kind of the double whammy, I think, in a lot of alfalfa fields that I'm aware of, is they get hayed in the summer, and then sometimes they are winter grazing on top of that, or they're feeding it back out, which I guess feeding it back out on the field it came from is probably the best we can hope for, in that scenario. But so they're haying it and then removing more of that cover through the winter grazing. So would changing the season of livestock integration help? Would it be better if there was, you know, maybe one out of every however many years, 7 years, let's just say, they actually just straight up grazed that portion of the hay field during the growing season, or you know, at some other point other than just the dead of winter? Does it matter when the cattle are integrated or when the livestock are integrated?
Sure. Yeah. And then how much stress you're putting on that field, based on how frequently you're grazing it and whether you're allowing it to rest. Those are really important components. How high of a stocking density you're putting out there, how frequently you move them, and how long of a rest period you have. Those all affect the pasture's sort of stress level and whether or not it can resist things like insect pests and other things.
Sure. Let's move on then to a different insect pest that we think about, and especially in this season, this will be out just here next Monday. So it's fairly quick turnaround today from the interview to the time that it's released. But a lot of people are dealing with fly pressure on their livestock. Is a bird the most natural predator for a fly, or are there other even insect predators that flies that can help with flies and fly pressure on livestock?
Yeah. So the worst thing you can do to try to control flies is apply insecticides. We have found that insecticides end up, the more you use, the more fly pressure you end up having. And so we've got data on that. And I'm not saying that flies aren't an issue, and I'm not saying that all you do is abandon fly or like insecticides or Ivermex or whatever it is that people want to put on. And what you end up having to do is replace those agrochemicals using good management practices. And so those are in a rangeland system: keep the cows tight, move them frequently, and let it rest, and then get off of the jugs. Those are the more people do that, the less problems that they have with pests of various sorts, fecal parasites and flies.
Gotcha. And is the mechanism there breaking the parasite cycle?
Yeah, I think part of it is moving those animals farther away from where the flies might be breeding. It makes a moving target of sorts. The animal behavior is different. They end up being healthier and able to resist fly pressure. On our sheep, we raise sheep out here. Is the only flies that I saw was on a ewe that had some health problems. And occasionally you'd see them on the other ones too. Boy, they glommed onto her. Selecting cattle genetics, if cows are your thing, then selecting for genetics and looking at those different animals and seeing which ones have lots of flies on them and which ones don't, and start using that as a decision-making framework for culling the herd is another great idea, another opportunity there. Why else? Because that approach to grazing, right? Like I said, keeping them tight, moving them, letting it rest, that inspires insect diversity. And insect diversity is what combats fly pressure and fecal parasites and other pests of livestock. And so it does it in a variety of different ways. In some ways, we don't even know, right? But we know it works. So predation, competition for resources, so it outcompetes the pest species, some of the other insects that you might be getting into that system. In the case of filth breeding flies, you would get opportunities to recycle those nutrients down more quickly into the soil, and so remove those as a resource for flies. So those are all ways that we know that it seems to work.
Do you have any kind of a recommended process? I mean, you said it's not necessarily just quitting everything. I don't know, cold turkey, maybe is that a word? Is that the word for it? But do you have a process that you've recommended people go through, or is every situation different? What is your thoughts on how people can move away from some of these things?
We're of the mind that you have to have a full system, but you don't have to bet the whole ranch on it or farm on it, right? Not maybe that first year. Practice with a small component of your herd and land. If rangelands are your thing, integrate sheep and cattle together on a 40 acre pasture or something like that. Move them frequently, get your system, get your fencing down, getting all of those ducks in a row so that when you're ready, you can start to scale it up. And these things do scale up, but practice at it. Don't go whole hog right away, because that ends up biting you in the butt a little bit sometimes. But also don't just go half-heartedly. Don't like, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, graze the same pasture again, you know, 15 days later or something with a high density of cows. No, no, it's got to be the full system. You actually have to adopt that, all of those different components, right? In order for this to be successful.
You mentioned genetics and resistance or selecting animals that are, I don't know if resistance is the right word, but we'll use resistance for to the parasites or the pests. What is the mechanism there, or do we know what is it about certain animals? Is it just that you mentioned the one sheep that was ill or whatever? Is it just there's a weakened immune system there that's attracting those things, or what's the mechanism there that makes some individuals in a herd more resistant than others?
Well, we don't always know the mechanisms, unfortunately, and that's true of most even host plant resistance to insect pests in the case of crops, but livestock, I think we know even less. Some of it might be behavioral. Maybe they're moving or standing in the right place in a pasture so that they're, maybe it's shadier there or less shady, or maybe they are able to, you know, jiggle their skin just the right way or something along those lines. Maybe it's behavioral. Maybe it's chemical. Flies and other pests end up being attracted to an animal, just like whenever I go camping or on a hike, I want to go with my dad because that man is a magnet for mosquitoes. And I don't know what it is, but I keep him close so that I don't have any mosquito problems when I've gone on a hike. And it's true for animals too. Different animals have different chemical makeups. Maybe it's the lactic acid that they're producing in their muscles. Maybe it's something in their breath when they're breathing it out that it's particularly attractive to biting flies or something. So could be any those things for sure.
Yeah. So you mentioned kind of the answer is could be a lot of things, or maybe a more, another way to say it is we don't know, which is what you did say. So could you talk a little bit about I'll phrase it this way, the need for humility in approaching management?
Absolutely.
You know, like, we don't know, and there's unintended consequences for using the tools that we do have available to us. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I'm a scientist, right, by training. And yes, I started out as an entomologist, but I've had to learn where insects fit within that environment. And so I'm much more of an agroecologist now than I am an entomologist. As such, I want to understand the mechanisms. Why do things work? You know, and so science that is very mechanistic in nature ends up ignoring sometimes the system. We try to partition things so finely and control every little aspect that we lose sight of the larger forest because of the trees. And so in regenerative agriculture, things have been changed. Systems have been developed that defy what science say can happen, because science was done outside of that system context. And so the farmers are really redefining what agriculture is capable of. And it's moving so quickly that science is really having to respond. And that requires a certain humility, right? Scientists are no longer the experts anymore in this realm. The farmers and ranchers, beekeepers are the experts. But science still has a real value there, and we can use that to apply. Sometimes we don't understand why these systems work. And that's a hard pill to swallow. I mean, we want to take, because gosh darn it, if we're going to optimize these things and make the best management decisions, we have to know exactly what it is about that system that worked best so that it removes the ambiguity. But biology is complicated, and it's not something that you can model. it's not something very, very efficiently, and it's not something that you can always predict. It's like the weather. And so getting out of the way and allowing nature to run its course sometimes is pride swallowing. It's scary, but it's oftentimes the best medicine. So figuring out how to work with Mother Nature as opposed to battling against her and thinking we're in control ends up becoming a much more resilient business model for farmers.
There's an interesting graph out there that Steve Kenyon shares often of farm profitability and, you know, and then the farm businesses, which is kind of funny that we separate people selling things to farmers and their businesses, but farms, they're not businesses. But that's another discussion for another time.
Yeah, right.
But the farm business profitability has kind of skyrocketed, and individual farm profitability has kind of in a correlating arc gone down. And I've heard that too, you know, even with whatever corn is at these days. I'm sorry, I don't pay that close of attention to it, but it's $6 or something in that neighborhood, that everybody kind of is anticipating, well, our inputs are just going to cost more, even though we're getting a better price for our corn this year, our inputs are going to cost more. So there was a time before all of these things when farming was profitable and farming was somewhat more natural. And so is it as simple as kind of returning to those things and taking a hands-off approach, or how do we decide when and where to intervene and when and where not to intervene?
Well, farming is it's a management exercise, right? We're trying to manage the natural world. And understanding which aspects of the natural world that we're trying to replicate imperfectly is that's the trick, right? We're replicating the natural world very poorly in most farming systems, right? And so key elements there are, integrating plants and animals together, stacking enterprises, you know, not just relying on a single enterprise in order to be a profitable operation. How to manage those animals and plants so that they replicate how organisms fit within the natural world. Those are all key elements of how to strategize your own business model. So we can pare it down to principles that seem to be successful. And, in rangeland systems, it's just what I've been saying too many times probably is keep them tight, move them often, and let it rest. That seems to work. But the reason it works is because the plant communities are adapted to that, right? I mean, that's how grazing animals used to run.
So a lot of times, as far as in a plant community, we look at things as a weed, you know, and quote unquote, you know, a lot of people, and whenever I say weeds, especially if I mention them pejoratively, I usually get an email saying if it's green and growing, it's forage, right? I've got evidence to back that up. I've seen my cows and my sheep eat, you know, things that people would classify as a weed. And I think that there's sometimes, maybe a little deeper look at that. They talk about a succession of the plant community happening. Is there a correlation to that or something similar to that in the bug community? That these are here now, but when this is healthier, they won't be. Is there a correlation to that in the bug community?
Sure. I mean, weeds are just plants that are regarded as pests, and it's the same sort of a philosophy there. You have to look at problems as opportunities somehow. If grasshoppers are getting too high, incorporate you know, poultry in your operation, maybe, or see if there's opportunities there that can be exploited to make you more successful. And invariably, that means increasing the diversity of revenue streams that are being produced by your farm. Insects are pests, you know, they blow in and they're trying to regulate a problem within your system. And when that problem is solved, they go away.
Yeah, you made an interesting statement earlier that I want to see if I'm understanding it correctly. You said that that a lot of times the insect pests that we have in a monocrop system are trying to get away from the monoculture. Is this an accurate understanding that those things are trying to stress the plants that are there so that other plants that aren't part of the monoculture that's currently there can have a chance to grow? Is that a accurate way to look at it?
Yeah, I think that's partially true. The other aspect of that is that when plants are grown under a monoculture, they're stressed. I mean, even our high yielding corn hybrids or what have you, those plants are stressed. They do not belong in a monoculture like that. And so as a result, they tend to be very susceptible to insect attack. And a lot of times we even breed out. When you look at Teosinte or some of the ancestral lines of soybeans or wheat or what have you, those plants had myriad ways of chemically defending or structurally defending themselves against insect pests. And we selected against that. Mm. We wanted a big seed. And so much of our breeding efforts focus solely on that trait, or maybe shatterproof or whatever, very isolated sets of traits. And as a result of that, we end up with animals and plants that do not resist pests very well. And so on one element, the insects and the pests are there to stress that organism to allow other competition to take hold. But on the other hand, they're also an artifact. The pests are an artifact of that system that we've designed. And so at the end of the day, in both cases, the answer is the same, diversification.
Yeah. So would you say that it's possible in a healthy rangeland system to fence your property for grasshoppers? In a limited way?
Fence the property for grasshoppers. What do you mean?
I mean, you grow healthier plants that aren't stressed and don't attract grasshoppers.
Yes, correct. I mean, grasshoppers, you know, they're coming in, they love bare soil. Mm. And so they're coming in from areas, maybe it's your neighbor, maybe it's on your own place where there's bare soil or stressed plant communities. As you diversify the forage community and also have animals at high densities, they tend to trample grasshopper egg pods. They tend to foster additional predator like mulloids or blister beetles or crickets or other predators of grasshopper egg stages. And when you remove that plant community or animal community or allow it to behave outside of its normal desire, then it ends up producing grasshopper populations.
So I'm a small scale operator here in Western South Dakota. Is there a scale that's necessary to, and I don't know if this was the right way to say it or not, but to break that parasite cycle, to, you know, moving your cattle far enough away from the dung pats to, you know, get away from the new hatching of the larva. Is there a scale that's necessary to make that happen, or is there another class of livestock or species that I should look at to make that happen?
Well, you know, I mean, getting poultry into that system and diversifying the different niches of grazing animals, that's an important step. You know, monocultures refer to cattle operations just as well as they do to cornfields. So if it's a monoculture of animals, then it's you'd end up seeing very similar implications of that. That doesn't mean that every group of livestock behaves well together. We tried putting the pigs with the sheep, and that didn't work well at all. So the pigs like to be a pain in the neck to the sheep. So we had to break them up and follow them in series as opposed to...
Rather than running enough cows to make it make sense to move your cows a quarter of a mile away every day, the easier solution would be to get some pastured layers out there running behind the cattle. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Sure. Yeah, that might really help a lot. And again, this is a situation where you're ahead of the science. And so, what's the best, what's the best density of layers or how closely do they need to be integrated or how frequently do you need to move? Well, that becomes the art form of farming. And we're hoping to start generating the data to be able to support that kind of decision making, but we're not there yet.
I think of being a, like I said, a smaller scale operator here in Western South Dakota, the number of acres I manage, in Eastern South Dakota would be considered a lot, but it's just the nature of being in a drier climate. But as you go east, you get more moisture, and that will result in more life, let's say, rather than pests or parasites, we'll just say life. That'll result in more life being present in the system. So can you talk about the complexity of managing an area where there's more life? I mean, you're in Eastern South Dakota and in a pretty wet environment.
Not this year.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's, there are opportunities there. How are you guys handling that? You're on a place where you are tighter. All of your enterprises are tighter. Is there a way of that you've structured it to mitigate those pressures?
Yeah. I mean, we stack. And so we've got limited, we have 53 acres, and we're running 50 ewes and their lambs. And then we've got a couple of pasture pigs. We've got some layers. We've got some broilers. We have an orchard. We have a half of the farm is native unbroken prairie and wetlands. How do we do it? Well, we have to put together a plan. And we know on the farm, it's taken a few years where the green stuff is going to be at different times of the year so we can get the sheep out there and make sure that we've got a plan for keeping them moving at the correct rate. And some of that you can pencil out and some of it you've got to watch. Like this year we have, until this last couple of weeks, I think we had about 3 inches of rain all summer. And so those wetlands that people normally in our area love to drain, those things saved the farm because we ended up having forage down there for keeping the sheep happy. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. No, I think stacking and diversity.
Yeah. Sorry to be a broken record.
No, it's good. It's good. I appreciate it. I guess maybe the direction to head is, a lot of these discussions kind of get, they just fall into the echo chamber where people who already think this way are going to listen to this and they'll clap along as they're stringing polywire fence so that they can keep their cows tight and moving and allow rest, so how do we, is it hosting farm field days? What do we do to get this message out to our neighbors? The cynical approach is wait to be able to lease their place, but how do we help neighbors start to think differently about these things?
Yeah. And this is another humbling aspect because science generates data that should be used for making decisions, right? And we should be a data driven society and we'll use data for making all of our choices. Right. But we're not. And data and science are necessary, but they are not sufficient for influencing behavioral change in our food community. And so what is it that's important? It's relationships and trust and credibility. And data is important, absolutely necessary, but without trust, you're not going to change people. And so that's one of the reasons why we started Food Ashra the way that we did at Ignisys Foundation as our science, is that, you know, for our science to hold, we had to become farmers and beekeepers and ranchers, because we needed that relationship. We needed that firsthand experience. And until we did that, we really, we could shout advice. But we couldn't shout the fact that, you know, I tried that too, and it just didn't work, you know, or that did work, as the case may be. So to me, it's relationships, field days, people being bold enough to change within their community and then being successful at it. Those are all really important aspects.
Hmm. You know, you started to say that data should make our decisions, and we should be a data-driven society. And the thought that came to my mind is that we're actually probably a paradigm-driven society, is that I find people who think like me, and I find people who reinforce my paradigms.
More and more, too, doesn't it? Or maybe I didn't live in the past, so who knows? Yeah. But it just feels like that's really on the upswing. Like we're all looking for our tribe, who we identify with. And that's the people that we're going to believe and trust and work with. Mm-hmm. And being able to cross amongst tribes right now is going to be really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're kind of amidst a, you know, I'm a biologist, right? So I think in terms of evolution and how and natural selection and things along those lines, I don't think that's all that's at play, but I do think that that's an important aspect of the natural world. We're undergoing natural selection of which ranchers and farmers are going to still be around. And it isn't, evolution isn't pretty. It's and
survival of the fittest means there's casualties that aren't fit.
Too many. And Ignisys Foundation is trying its damnedest to make sure that that's a very small number. But you can't change somebody that's not willing. So,
yeah. Are there bellwether species as far as insects are concerned? I mean, I think, is that part of the reason why you chose Blue Dasher as your as a name?
Blue Dasher is a dragonfly. Yeah. It's a good ecosystem indicator. It's a good indicator of environmental health. And they're good predators too. It's a cool bug at the end of the day.
How big are they? They're not that big.
Not too big. I don't know, maybe an inch and a half long or so.
Right. Are there other bellwether indicator species of
sure. I mean, if you've got lady beetles out there, you're doing great. If you have ants, you're doing great. If you've got lightning beetles, that's a good bellwether species. Dung beetles and your site, your dung pads are recycling, and that's a good sign.
What's a lightning beetle?
Firefly.
Oh, firefly. Okay.
Yeah, was, you know, they're actually beetles. They're not.
As soon as I asked the question, I ripped.
Nah, no, I'm glad you did.
Put it together.
Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, though, and we've been working with indicator species for a long time from a risk assessment standpoint, trying to figure out whether or not pesticides or genetically modified organisms are affecting the environment using indicator species. Maybe it's an ant or a lady beetle or something like that. At the end of the day, you know, I mean, we can try to figure out who some of these, you know, indicator groups are. I think, and we have the growing database to be able to test this for sure, it's the community. And its diversity in itself is really the indicator that we're after. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to provide platforms whereby farmers, ranchers can actually identify the diversity that's on the levels on their farm. And we should be able to have some tools available, hopefully within the next couple of years, so that people can do that. But that gets to be a lot more complicated. Farmers always want a dipstick, right? They want to be able to stick it into the ground and pull it out and say, okay, I'm doing good stuff, right? And there's a lot of drug salesmen and selling magic elixirs and different probes and tests and different things that some of them might work, some of them might not. We don't know, but they're all based on this farmer's desire to know whether or not it's working. And what I tell people is the best thing that they can test to know whether or not it's working on their farm is if you go out on your farm every day and you see something you never seen before. To me, that is the true test of a healthy farm. If you go out there and you see corn and soybeans and cows, then you're not going to see new things every day. But what that also does is it gives the farmer or land manager or whoever the opportunity to connect. And that connection is going to lead to wonderful things in a farming operation.
Even if those things were there all along, which in many cases they might not have been, but even if they were there all along, the difference is that now you're looking and now you're caring and now they are factoring in your decision-making.
Yeah. I mean, I was one of our scientists, Mike Briss, and I were driving past a soybean field, and he stopped the car and he looked at it and he said, that field right there, that piece of ground that was tilled twice, it was sprayed with herbicides, it was sprayed with the fungicide, and then it was planted, it was sprayed again, and it was planted with a seed, you know, that had different chemicals on it to protect it. And then it was sprayed with herbicides again, and then they flew over and they sprayed it with the fungicide and insecticide mid-season, and then they came through and harvested it and tilled it and sprayed it one more time. Human feet have never touched that piece of ground. Mm. Where's that connection? Mm. You know?
Yeah. You know, I think it was somebody told me that you said, so this is dangerous territory, but somebody there's enough, or maybe I'll just ask you, how many bees can the neonicotinoid on one corn seed, how many bees can that affect?
One seed has enough insecticide, I think, when we penciled it out, to kill about 164,000 bees. Mm. One seed.
We've racked our brains about where the bees are going, right? And a lot of, you know, people have tried to blame cell phone signals and this and that and everything. And I'm sure it's maybe a combination of a lot of different things. But can you talk a little bit about the impact of losing pollinators through some of these different unintended consequences?
Yeah, where the bees go, so go we. And so... when you were talking about bellwethers or indicator species, there's few that are better than a honeybee hive. Mm. And the reason being is that they forage for a few miles around their hives, and they bring back pollen and nectar from a wide variety of different floral species, and they put it in their hives and they raise their young on it. Many pesticides are lipophilic. They bind to waxes. Mm. And so a beehive ends up being this repository of most of the crap that's out in the environment. And so as these beehives are starting to tank, what you're viewing is a snapshot of the future of us. Mm. If we were to eliminate the pollen, right, we would lose a heck of a lot of our food and all of those things. Essentially, ecosystems would stop functioning. Most angiosperms are dependent on pollination. And if you don't have that, you don't get flowers and you don't get plants.
Again, it probably is back to diversity, but could you, I mean, you're in what I would look at as the heart of it, or at least as you go farther south and east, it continues to become more and more monoculture based from where you are. Can you pitch a vision? And I think the helpful, maybe the bridge to this vision, is that experimentation on a small scale that you talked about. Can you talk a little bit about a transition process away from monocultures, away from use of insecticides and neonicotinoids and those things, towards a more regenerative system? How does somebody go from farming 1,500 acres of soybeans and corn, you know, that's their rotation, to something that is a little bit more or a lot more regenerative?
Well, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but starting small and figuring out what a system looks like for you. Maybe that's perenniality in there, thinking about certainly eliminating all tillage from that system, getting always having roots on the ground, be that annual covers to be that perennial plant species. I have one section of Blue Dasher Farm where the only thing that grows are these dang elm trees from the shelter belt and on this field. And finally, Christine and I were talking. I'm like, you know what? If trees want to grow here, we're going to plant trees. And so we made that into an orchard and a jams and jellies garden kind of a thing. And we'll see whether or not we could, not stop battling against it and start figuring out how to make money off of it, you know, kind of. Working with it. Maybe it's, integrating livestock and crops into that same piece of ground on a small scale and then scaling it up. Because when you talk to regenerative farmers, they never try it and give up. I've not seen that very often. It tends to be a one-way street. Once you start getting into this stuff, you realize that this is the answer to many, many issues. And, it doesn't make it easy. That doesn't make it, a complete, cookie cutter kind of a situation. What it makes it is a farm. A farm isn't a cookie cutter, you know. It's an art form.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. That's really, really good, really helpful. I'm somewhat familiar with your history a little bit. But you mentioned that part of the reason that you have started Blue Dasher Farm was to, if I can be so crude, is to lend credibility to the science that you're trying to capture.
Yeah.
You know, the
That's
data you're
exactly
trying to
what
capture.
You're trying to do, yeah.
So can you talk about the lessons you learned? Some of the, and we could call them failures, but they were just teaching moments. You know, could you talk about some of those things as you got started?
Yeah. So I worked with USDA for about 11 years. And then 2016, I quit and we started Ecdysis Foundation, Blue Dasher Farm. And there are two sides of a coin. Blue Dasher Farm is a training ground for young scientists to get experiential knowledge. It's an operating farm, but it's also an educational place. And Ecdysis is doing the science on that side of it, and so the primary research. And so scientists and farmers are merged into one unit that influences the questions that we ask substantially. We don't do any research really on Blue Dasher Farm. We do all of our science is done out on ranches and farms and beehives around the region or even the nation, the continent, in fact. So that's one big thing, is that we look at best management practices as they are generated by the farmers themselves. And so we learn from you guys. It's really an important aspect of it. Mm. And then we also address questions from a very practical standpoint. You know, I mean, one of the harder things that I've had to learn as, because I was never a farmer, right? I gave advice to farmers, but I was never a farmer and I was never a beekeeper or a rancher. And that's different, right? You don't have months or years to parse out the best possible situation for an immediate decision that needs to be made tomorrow. You got to get it done. You got to shoot from the hip. And that is oftentimes in the face of science, right? Science is like, oh, I see. So you've got to make this decision. Okay, well, we need to replicate this. We need to experimentally, you know, increase our density of sheep to figure out exactly which one is optimal for this particular pasture. And at the end of the day, I'm like, no, sheep are breaking out, move them, you know, kind of a thing. And that's a huge difference between science and farming. Mm. But it influences the types of questions we ask them, for sure.
Yeah. Could you talk about the history of the place that you're on? What was Blue Dasher Farm before you started?
You know, we bought it. It was half native unbroken prairie and wetlands. It's that was not managed at all. It was sprayed with herbicides. And then it had some CRP contracts that were used, a lot of lawn that we ended up planting into prairie. And it was just, it was kind of a hobby place, really, if anything. And we kind of turned it in. We've started to incorporate fire and grazing into managing the prairie. And it is one of the top prairies in the region, I think, in terms of diversity and some really unique plant species that's really dominated by. And then we started to incorporate things into there, like trying to figure out how to balance the annual cropping with perennial warm season grasses and managing that with grazing and fire and those sorts of questions. So,
what is the annual cropping side of it?
Well, we're trying to plant a polymix. Our biggest input cost is feed. And so what we're hoping is that if we could plant an annual mix that's got barley and rye and wheat and peas, flax, and there's a few other things in there too, I'm sure, and manage to take a crop off, that we can reduce or eliminate all of our input costs from Blue Dasher Farm, and then just becomes all profits. The more we can do that, the happier I am. The trick is that, I mean, we're farming in the prairie, more or less, and not the native parts of the prairie, but certainly we're farming in native perennial warm season grasses, and we don't want to eliminate those. We want to work with them. Mm-hmm. And so incorporating tools like fire, grazing, competition, timing is essential. And so we're figuring out how to do that.
So is there some strategy of severe grazing and then planting a cover crop, or how is that working?
Yeah, that's the idea. No, we don't plant covers under that. The native vegetation is pretty competitive, and so we don't need covers, really. What we're after is, yes, intense graze. Actually, we use fire and then intense grazing in order to suppress the native plant communities. Then we go in, direct drill our annual crop, and then we're hoping to be able to put it all in the bin and then sort it out, or just grind it up and directly administer it to animals, and maybe with some supplementation from some other things to get protein up.
How long after the intense graze does the planting need to happen?
Well, before it usually. We try to get the seed in the ground and then we hit them. Our rotation is burn, And then plant the annual crop. We have three fields that we're working with. So we've got a three-legged rotation. The next year is graze it heavy all year. Third year is let it rest and build up thatch. Then the fourth year it goes back into burn and annual crop. We've had a couple of years where we were successful getting that annual crop in and off of the ground. We're still playing around with that, though, so we're still making some mistakes, some learning, but we have a vision of what this could look like, so I'm hoping that we can figure it all out.
So I just kind of as we point towards wrapping up, I guess, so I'll talk about, or I'll ask you to talk a little bit about some of the maybe bridges to a more regenerative system, you know, that get pitched to people. One of the biggest struggles I've faced with the Working Cows podcast is monetizing it. I'm I'm running a podcast where I tell people you don't need to buy anything, and nobody wants to pay me to tell people you don't need to buy anything. So, you know, but we do see products on the market, bug in a jug type things, and some of those things, or I've heard of people wanting to import like roller beetles and some of those things. Like we see dung beetles, and we have seen dung beetles since the start of our first growing season of management, just because we've removed, or I asked the guy that was bringing me cattle, I said, if you could avoid using any porons, you know, before they come, that would be great. And he said, yeah, I don't usually use them until in the winter anyways, so this won't be a problem. And so I think, you know, the first 3 days of cattle being there, I found dung beetles in the growing season anyways. So talk about some of those things, the bug in the jug type solutions, or the importing of beetles from other places, because I've only ever seen dwellers. I've never seen rollers. I've never seen, I don't remember what the third kind is, but I've never seen them on my place yet. I don't know if I will. I know people 50 miles northeast of me see them, but I don't know if I will. So
at the end of the day, if you build it, they will come. And I think that plants and animals are extremely powerful tools, and usually they're better tools than the ones that are bugs in a jug kind of a thing, or magic elixirs or whatever. That means that you end up having to have a situation where you are building a habitat so that it can receive, you know, life on your farm. And so if you don't have that habitat, you're going to continue to buy magic elixirs or jugs of various sorts in order to make your system productive. So the way you get that habitat is through proper management of animals and plants.
Diversity. High density.
Yeah.
Moving that way.
There you go.
Just to bring it full circle.
There you have it. There you
I thank you for your time today. Is there a place we could send people in the show notes page today? workingcows.net/205. workingcows.net/205 is the show notes page for today. Could we send some, put some links up there for where you'll be next, or how people can come and see what you're doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. Blue Dasher Farm, bluedasher.farm is our website. Ecdysis.bio is our science website, ECDYSIS. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter is Bug Lundgren. And like what you see, consider supporting it. We can't do it without you.
Well, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Take care.
Very good stuff there. Really appreciate Dr. Lundgren taking the time to join me today. Looking forward to next week, getting a perspective about how EPDs can be used in a commercial situation, and talking to Ryan Noble about that. And Ryan is always a very, very thoughtful guy, and always has a real good business mindset with his approach to how things are done, even down to EPDs and their role in a commercial operation. So look forward to that real soon on the next episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.